Today is the 28th of October 2018. And for Teisho today, we're going to look into a story. It's called Miao Zong's Dharma Encounter. And it comes from The Hidden Lamp, Stories from 25 Centuries of Awakened Women, edited by Florence Kaplow and Susan Moon. This book was published in 2013, and it brings together in one volume 100 stories about women, mostly in Chan and Zen, but also from other traditions. And it's drawing on scholarship and research that's mostly been done over the past 20 years or so largely by women scholars, not entirely. When I first started looking into this whole question of women in our tradition, and when I realized that 99% of the koans had male protagonists and there wasn't a single woman in our ancestral line, I started looking into it, and I was basically relying on the library upstairs. And there was not very much material. We did have a copy of a master's thesis that Audrey Fernandez did when she studied Chinese about this very issue, which was a source, and a few other things. I heard about something called the Kahawai Koans. The women in the Diamond Sangha had looked into this too, and they'd got the help of one of the Cleary brothers to help gather together the stories that were around into a collection, and I managed to get hold of a copy of that. But since that time, so much more is known now about the women in our tradition. So much so that we can't really say unknown women anymore. We change that part of our the end of the ancestral line to unsung women at a certain point, because we do know about some of them now. And then eventually we also adopted a chant which has the names of many of the women in it, which we call the Pool of Radiance, based on one that's been done in Sweden for a number of years. But anyhow, this book is a great resource, gathering all these stories in one place and inviting women teachers to comment on them. I'll also be drawing a little bit on another book called, this is an earlier one, let's see, 2009, called Zen Women Beyond Tea Ladies, Iron Maidens and Macho Masters, and it's by Grace Shireson. And at the beginning of it, she says something which is relevant to our topic today. She says, to mention women in Zen is to jump right into the middle of a controversy about whether gender matters at all. Zen Buddhists and their Buddhist forebears have made the revolutionary declaration that there is no essential difference in the spiritual experience available to all human beings, regardless of race, class, or gender. The Zen tradition has established on core teachings that view all phenomenal experience as empty of fixed substance. In this context, how could gender be the basis for any essential differentiation? Yet Zen is historically an all-male tradition. How does the espoused theory match up with the historical reality? The troublesome question of Zen and gender comes to life in an examination of the place of women in Zen's history. And the place of women in Buddhism as well. We can't go into too much detail here, we don't have time. But just to make three points about the history of women in Buddhism as a whole. Right at the start, people probably know that the establishment of the order of female monks happened when Mahaprajapati, the Buddha's aunt and stepmother, pleaded with him to accept women into the order of homeless ones. And she got Ananda's help in this, who asked the Buddha three times, and three times he was refused. And there was a tradition then that you couldn't ask exactly the same question more than three times. So he was up against the wall there. And then he changed his tack and he asked, "Well, Lord, can women attain enlightenment?" And when asked that question, he had to concede that yes, they could. And so that was the beginning of the women's order. But he brought in at that time what's known as the eight special rules. And basically these rules subordinated the order of female monks to that of the male monks in different ways. But for example, the first one is that the most senior female monk had to bow down before the most junior male monk. And from a spiritual point of view, you could say that that's not a problem. But over time, it was to have consequences. These eight special rules would have consequences because it made it harder for the communities of female monks to be economically viable in the long run. The convents were often impoverished, or the collections of practitioners. Probably there was some assumption among followers that the lower status of the women implied that they were less worthy of offerings. In other words, the giver would get less merit. So in the long span, in the 2,500 year span of Buddhist history, the order of female monks did in fact die out in many places. Not all, but many. So that's one factor. As in many other religions and societies, women have often been seen as dangerous temptresses, and this notion, this projection, continues to this day. And so there are many admonitions to monks to stay away from women, to have no contact with them. And it came to be that the female body was seen as something inherently impure. I just want to give you a little example of this. This is from the Zen Women book, and it's from the Pali Suttas, story from the Pali Suttas. Sudina, previously a married man, had lapsed in his practice of celibacy and confessed this fact to the Buddha. Sudana had engaged in sex to impregnate his ex-wife to assuage her grief over her loss of her husband, himself, to the Buddhist order. Sudana tried to emphasize the selflessness of his sexual act with his ex-wife and his sense of repulsion toward her. His sense of family duty conflicted with the Buddha's command that he sever ties to his family. The Buddha rebuked Sudana over this defeat and this failure in his practice. And here's what it says in the sutta. So brace yourselves, everybody. It would have been better, confused man, had you put your male organ inside the mouth of a terrible poisonous snake than inside the vagina of a woman. It would have been better, confused man, had you put your male organ inside the mouth of a black snake than inside the vagina of a woman. It would have been better, confused man, had you put your male organ inside a blazing hot charcoal pit than inside the vagina of a woman. And Shiasan comments on this. Thus it seems that according to the Buddha and to later Buddhist or to later Buddhist editorial editions, a woman's vagina and sexual intercourse are more dangerous to a monk's practice than the harm caused by a poisonous snake or a burning charcoal pit. While it is not so hard to understand the Buddha's warning against sexual pursuits, this admonition carries quite a charge. Far from manifesting a cool, dispassionate and mindful approach, the Buddha's admonition sounds almost hysterical. And of course, with all these things, both with the eight special rules or teachings like this, we don't know whether this came from the Buddha or from later editions. But in the long run, it doesn't really matter, because it still has an effect as if it came from the Buddha, if it's there in the sutras. And there are many other examples like this. There are also statements about the fact that women do have the potential to awaken, but these predictions onto the female body are often pretty strong like this. And we can see their effects continuing today in some places. For instance, in Thailand, where monks pride themselves on adhering to the original teachings of the Buddha, in many places women aren't allowed to enter the inner sanctums of temples. And the reason that's given is that they might be having their period. So, in other words, they're seen as being kind of ritually impure, and that they would somehow taint the sacred space if they were to enter it. And other examples from Thailand, when we were there in 1999, I think it was, 98. Anyway, we were in Thailand on holiday, and we met a monk who wanted us to come and meet his classmates. They were teenagers in a language school, and because we spoke English, he wanted us to talk to his classmates. And he set up a microphone so that everybody could hear us, but he couldn't pass the microphone to me because I was female, and that would be, even if it was just holding the same object, that was considered to be touching. So he had to pass it to Richard, and then Richard had to pass it to me. Now, these are little things, but you can imagine what message they send to girls growing up in this kind of culture. Another thing from Thailand is that the rite of passage for young boys is becoming a monk for a while, and that's a very important experience for young Thai boys. But this is not something that girls can do, because they're girls. And actually, often in poor Thai families, girls will the rite of passage for them will be becoming a prostitute in order to support the family for a while. So very, very different outcomes for boys and girls. And just in case people might think this is only to be found in the Theravada tradition, there are pockets of unhelpful messages within the Mahayana as well. Until quite recently, if you were a Tibetan nun, one of the main prayers you would do would be to pray to be reborn as a man, so that you could reach full enlightenment, because it was considered not possible to do this in the female body. And modern Chinese teachers have emphasized this too. The master who started the City of 10,000 Buddhas, Xuanhua, there are lots of passages from his teachings where he goes into detail why it is not possible for women to come to awakening. So we can just have these things in the background and turn to our story from the Hidden Lamp for today. Miao Zong's Dharma Interview. This is from 12th century China. Before Miao Zong became a nun, she used to visit Master Da Hui Zonggao's monastery to study with him, and he gave her a room in the abbot's quarters. The senior monk, Wan An, did not approve. Da Hui said to him, "Although she's a woman, she has outstanding merits." Wan An still disapproved, so Da Hui urged him to have an interview with Mao Zong. Wan An reluctantly agreed and requested an interview. Miao Zong said, "Do you want a Dharma interview or a worldly interview?" "A Dharma interview," replied Wan An. Miao Zong said, "Then send your attendants away." She went into the room first, and after a few moments she called, "Please come in." When Wan An entered, he saw Miao Zong lying naked on her back on the bed. He pointed at her genitals, saying, "What is this place?" Miao Zong replied, "All the Buddhas of the three worlds, the six patriarchs, and all great monks everywhere came out of this place." Wan An said, "And may I enter?" Miao Zong replied, "Horses may cross, asses may not." Wan An was unable to reply. Miao Zong declared, "I have met you, senior monk. The interview is over." She turned her back to him. Wan An left, ashamed. Later, Da Hui said to him, "The old dragon has some wisdom, doesn't she?" Okay, so that's the story. Just a little bit of biographical material on these three. Da Hui Zonggao, his dates are 1089 to 1163, and I don't think he needs too much of an introduction. He's the great 12th generation Linji master, who is very important for us as really the instigator of the kind of koan practice we do now here at the center, especially the what was called inspecting the critical phrase, looking into the nub of the koan, whether it's mu or what or who. His teacher, of course, was Yuan Wu, the co-author of the Hikigan Roku. And many of us have heard his teachings many, many times from the wonderful book Swampland Flowers, translated by Christopher Cleary, in which there are mostly his letters to his students. And he comes across as very, very compassionate, very, very rigorous. And interestingly, he was able to write letters to his students because 12th century China, Song Dynasty China, had a postal service to deliver the letters. So we have Da Hui, and then we have Miao Zong, and her dates are 1095 to 1170. And we have quite a bit of information, unusually detailed information about her. She was born into a prominent family. Her grandfather was actually the prime minister in the government. So she was highly educated, not only in Buddhist literature, but also Confucian and Taoist classics. But also she would have been highly constrained. Women in that time were expected to remain cloistered, out of sight mostly, not seen or heard. As a teenager, she had an awakening experience, just questioning her kind of natural koan on her own at home. And this natural koan was, where did this body come from in this life? And after it passes away, where will it go? This koan is quite similar to the question that gripped Ramana Maharshi at a similar age. What is it that dies? And like Ramana Maharshi, all on her own, she had some insight into this question. But she didn't tell anybody about it because she didn't realize that it was out of the ordinary, that it was something special. She didn't really get to understand what had happened until quite a bit later when she started to go and visit Chan masters. But in the meantime, she married somebody, a high-ranking scholar official, and was able to sometimes go with him when he went to monasteries to attend Chan lectures. From about the age of 30, she was visiting different Chan masters. And there's an account of one of these visits. This one is to a master Yuan. And I'm not sure whether this is it doesn't say it's Yuan Wu, but just a master Yuan. He asks her, "A well brought up, privileged lady from a wealthy family, how can you be prepared for the business of a great hero?" And the word he uses here for great hero is Chang Fu, Chinese Chang Fu. And it very much implied a great male hero. The meaning of it was something like a manly man. So it's used in Chan circles to describe the Bodhisattva coming to awakening. So he's being a bit provocative here. You know, how could you think to be coming here for Chan training? A little bit like the question that the fifth patriarch asked Hui Neng. So she replies, "Does the Dharma distinguish between male and female forms?" Yuan questioned her further. He said, "What is the Buddha? This mind is the Buddha. What about you?" Again, he's quoting Basso here. Miao Zong replied, "I've heard of you for a long time. I'm disappointed to find that you still say that kind of thing." So she was giving as good as she got. And here, perhaps echoing what, or saying a similar thing to what Mumon says in his commentary to the Koan, "Mind is Buddha." Tai Bai asks Basso, "What is Buddha?" And Basso replies, "This very mind is Buddha." And then Mumon in his commentary says, "Don't you know that after uttering the word Buddha, you should rinse your mouth out for 3 days?" So Mao Zedong seems to be saying a similar kind of thing. "I'm so disappointed to hear you spouting platitudes about Buddha and mind." And after this this encounter, Master Yuan commented, "Oh, you're a real lion cub." A lion cub. Someone with potential. Great potential. Later on, Mount Miaozong met Da Hui. It was in 1137. Again, a little bit from Zen Woman about her meeting with her first meeting with him. she encountered him at a public talk, and she, after the talk, she just walked up to him, bowed silently, and left. And Dawei said to the monk who was standing next to him, "That woman who just came, she has seen something, but she has not yet encountered the hammer and tongs, the forge and bellows of a real master. She is just like a 1,000-ton ship in a closed-off harbour. She still cannot move." So he immediately saw, again, like Yuan, Master Yuan, he saw her potential. And she had obviously seen something in him that to which she responded very powerfully. And so just the following year, after this first encounter, she was able to participate in a 3-month retreat along with Da Hui and his assembly of 1,700 monks. I read this, I thought, God, you can imagine the logistics of a 3-month session with 1,700 participants. But during this retreat, at some point, she experienced a deeper awakening. She was 43 years old at this point and still a laywoman. She wrote a verse. "Suddenly I came across my nose. My cleverness was like ice melting and tiles crumbling. Why did Bodhidharma need to come from India? The second patriarch did not need to give 3 bows. If you still ask why Bodhidharma came from the West, you bandits are defeated utterly." And at some point after this, she became Da Hui's 14th Dharma heir. And Da Hui would send his female students to her. She wasn't ordained until 1162. She was 67 at that time, and perhaps that happened when she became a widow. We don't know. But it was only 8 years before her death. A magistrate ordered her to take over a convent, Sersho Convent. And she was the abbess and teacher there for several years. Da Hui wrote about her quite glowingly in his own writings, which is probably why we have information about her generally, because she was so highly regarded by him. Some of her poetry has survived, and 43 koan commentaries as well. She was a great inspiration to later women, both in Ming China and in Kamakura, Japan. And of course, she's an inspiration for us too. The story that we're going to look at in a little bit more detail in a moment or two would have taken place at some point during her training. She would have continued to train with Da Hui after her awakening experience, and that's probably when it happened. And she was staying in Da Hui's monastery. The third character we have in this story is Huanan, the head monk. And we don't have any dates for him. And I couldn't find anything else except just what we know from the story. But to his credit, he's the one who recorded the encounter and included it in his own writings, Dharma writings. So let's just have a little bit more of a look at this exchange between Wainan and Yao Zong. So before Miao Zong became a nun, she used to visit Master Dahui Zonggao's monastery to study with him, to practice with him, in other words. And he gave her a room in the abbot's quarters. The senior monk, Wainan, did not approve. So this is a big monastery, but probably the monks lived in a giant hall, dormitory style, what we call marae style in New Zealand. In other words, all together sleeping side by side in this large room, which then would become the zendo during the day. So no privacy at all, and obviously not suitable for Miao Zong to stay there. But there were the abbot's quarters, and usually these would have rooms, guest rooms, for visiting dignitaries, and so it made sense for Miao Zong to stay there, so she could join in the practice. But Wainan was not happy with this. It says he's the senior monk and the leader of the Sangha hall, so something like equivalent to the head of the Zendo. So his job was to uphold the rules, and specifically the monastic rules. And women were not supposed to be living in monasteries. And on top of that, it didn't look good to have a woman staying in the abbot's quarters. Dahui might be suspected of having an affair if he was lodging a woman right there next to his own private rooms. And Wainan would have been concerned about this, concerned about the reputation of the monastery. And apparently, Dahui's teacher, Yuan Wu, was not without blame in this particular regard, and perhaps Wainan knew about this. So it was his job to consider the effect of this on the discipline of the monastery and of the monks. So it's quite appropriate for him to come to Dahui with his concerns. So Dahui responded to his head monk by saying, although she's a woman, she has outstanding merits. And then the story goes on to say, Wainan still disapproved, so Dahui urged him to have an interview with Miao Zong. So these stories often compress things. So perhaps he came back to Wainan came back to Dahui more than once with his concerns, and was not happy, did not consider Dahui's assurances about what was going on. He didn't think they were good enough. Dahui maybe felt he was being pestered about this, perhaps vehemently. And so he suggests to Wainan that he needs to go and have an interview with Miao Zong, see for himself what her qualities, her outstanding merits were. Maybe he thought that Wainan needed to undergo a little bit of consciousness raising here about women. So Wainan reluctantly agrees to Dahui's suggestion and requests an interview. And that the reluctance would have probably been to do with many things, but he would probably be aware of her strengths, her ability to engage with masters. He may also have been apprehensive about having to be in conflict with her. So anyway, he gets to the guests' quarters, and Miao Zong is there. And Miao Zong asks him, "Do you want a Dharma interview, or do you want a worldly interview?" And Wan An replies, "A Dharma interview." So a Dharma interview essentially means a Doksan-like encounter. So really, in Doksan, the point of Doksan is to just look into the truth of this moment, face to face. But then Miao Zong says, in order for that to happen, you need to send away your attendants. Wan An had come to this encounter with a retinue, perhaps because he was worried about being alone in a room with a woman and what that might do for his reputation. But also having a retinue following you around is kind of a status symbol. And a sign really of his worldly status as the head of the Sangha Hall. So in Miao Zong saying dismiss your retinue, she's really saying leave all that behind, leave it at the door. And let's have a meeting that's just human being to human being. And then she slips into the room, and then after a few minutes, she says, "Please come in." And when Wan An enters, he sees Miao Zong lying naked on her back on the bed. And that's when he points at her genitals, saying, "What is this place?" So quite a courageous thing for Miao Zong to do, to take this, really she's taking this encounter to a whole new level, a level of vulnerability on her part, and mischievousness is too, that's for sure, and so direct. She's really saying, well, let's get straight to the point. What is really the issue here? When we look at Wan An's question, what is this place? What's he really asking? So they've certainly got down to the nitty gritty. What is this place? It's like he's saying, what kind of place is that? What are you doing bringing that into a monastic setting? What has that to do in this place, this pure place? So really, with this question, he's put his cards on the table, and he's directly pointing to what he considers to be the problem. And therefore it also becomes clear to Miao Zong that she guessed correctly, that it was this fleshy opening, this her vagina, that was what was bothering Wan An. And then so she responds with this powerful statement. All the Buddhas of the three worlds, the six patriarchs, and all great monks everywhere come out of this place. She doesn't complain about how she's been treated or argue that should things be different. She just makes this demonstration. She makes this presentation. You may reject this place, but it is where every monk in this monastery came from. Then Wanan comes back and says, "And may I enter?" Now, we could interpret this in very literally and think that that he's propositioning her. But I think it's more a little more subtle than that. It's like he's saying, well, okay, so this is your approach. Are you willing to go all the way with it and go... to the logical outcome of your having emphasized this? This is what Shiasan from Zen Woman says about this. Wanan asks that Miaozong clarify her intention. "Since you are naked, Miss No Attachment to Propriety, is it your intention to have sex with me or not? What is your meaning, the extent of your non-attachment? Since you are willing to show it, will you also share it in the usual way with me, right here and right now?" So he's game. He's trying to stay in the room with what is in front of them, and respond to that. But it's still a limited response. We could say a sexist response, because he's not relating to Miaozong, the whole person, but really to her as a sexual being, and to her specifically her sexual organs as other, as outside the pale, you could say. And that's when she comes back with her response. "Horses may cross, asses may not." And some people would be recognize this as being a reworking of Joshu's response in the koan, Joshu's stone bridge. He's challenged by a monk who says, "I don't think much of you." Joshua's bridge. There was a famous stone bridge. Actually, it's still there in Shijiazhuang, where Joshua had his monastery. And this monk compares Joshua the teacher to the bridge, and Joshua replies that this bridge, you could say the bridge of his teaching, or his understanding, lets both horses and asses cross. Both bright and dull students. But here, Miaozong twists it a little bit and says, "Horses may cross, asses may not." So she dismisses him with this. And turns her back, saying, "I've met you, senior monk. The interview is over." Further embarrassing Wanan, and then he leaves. Again, to his credit, though, he goes to Da Wei and relates the story and the details of the story. And that's when he comments, "The old dragon has some wisdom, doesn't she?" And you have to remember here that old in China, in Song Dynasty China, is a compliment. She was probably in her 40s when this happened. Shiasan comments on this: "Miaozong answered Wanan and the entire Buddhist history that condemns women and their vaginas as sexual traps for aspiring monks." She really she really manages to present the messy truth about life on earth, that it involves such fleshy openings that bleed and give birth in a messy kind of way. So just to sum up, we asked the question right at the beginning, does gender matter if we're all fundamentally equal? Does it matter if 99% of the koans are about men, if they express things that are universal, things that are common to all of us, they express the human condition? Does it matter that there are only patriarchs in our ancestral line and no matriarchs? Shouldn't we be able to see through that to our essential nature that isn't male or female, not rich or poor or black or white? And yet, Yao Zong's life was shaped by the fact that she was a woman, and she was a woman of privilege, an extraordinary woman. As a woman, she had to face and understand her conditions, perhaps in a way that her Dharma brothers did not. She had to look into the nature of her sexuality, be conscious of it. Still today, masculinity, like whiteness, is what you could call an unmarked category. It's a category, and yet because it's the default, it's not seen particularly clearly, and we're not particularly aware of it, of what it means. Someone was telling me about a workshop that they attended recently, and it involved people from the Zen Center, white people largely, and some black people from a local union. And this is through ROC Acts, organized through them. And as part of this workshop, there was an exercise in which everybody lined up along the back of a room, and then people were asked 10 questions, and if you answered yes or agreed with the statement in the question, then you took a step forward. And examples of the questions, things like, when you apply for a bank loan, do you expect to get it? So if you answered yes to that, then you'd take a step forward. Or when you're stopped by the police for speeding, do you expect to be treated courteously? Or you have no relatives in prison, is another one. So after going through these 10 questions, the white people who'd answered them had advanced across the room, but the black folks were mainly still at the back. And obviously, you know, the point of such an exercise is to demonstrate in a concrete way the nature of white privilege, to understand it in our bodies, to see more clearly that privilege that we so often take completely for granted, and don't empathize with people who have a completely different experience. Rita Gross, it's a very fine scholar. She passed away, and some of her writings have been put out posthumously in a book called Buddhism Beyond Gender, Liberation from Attachment to Gender Identity. And she says something that is very applicable to this story that we've just looked into. She says, understanding shunyata and teachings on anatta, the no-self doctrine, can be done only through our lived reality. Within the undeniable imbalance of harm based on gender across the globe, we here face with understanding a phenomenon that is deeply real and yet still illusory. So discrimination, whether it's on the basis of gender or race or something else, sexual orientation, it's illusory. It's based on notions which have no substance, and yet at the same time, these ways in which we discriminate have effects on people. They shape people's lives. And to free ourselves from these delusions that have so much power, we have to see into them. We have to see them clearly, know them. And then they can be, we can free ourselves from them. Clearly, Miao Zong's teaching had an effect on Wan An, and after this encounter, he saw things differently. We'll stop here and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless fine passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of